Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio. Unplug, strap yourself in, because you are about to move beyond the matrix.
If you are hearing the sound of my voice, you have already moved beyond the matrix. You're listening to Rod Bryant and Jerry Gordon, my sidekick and researcher, the guy that if you want someone next to you in a fight, Jerry is the kind of guy that you need to have. He always has my 6 o'clock. I really appreciate him. And we have a very special guest coming that we've had on before. But once again, we bring people back on because the information that they provide is very timely and important. Jerry, why don't you take for a second and let's sort of prep and let the audience know what we're going to be talking about today.
Well, we're going to talk about some very significant developments in Iran regarding the zero purchase sanctions that President Trump and team have implemented, and also what's behind the wave of protests up there that may be significantly pointed to some ultimate collapse and or possible ingredients for regime change. Then following that, we're going to tee off on a brand new book that our guest has written and published actually this past week. It's called ISIS Begins. It's a very important saga, and I think Ken will elucidate what that's all about. And our guest is none other than Ken Timmerman,
the famous Ken Timmerman,
author of works like Dark Forces. And he also was a proposed, shall I say, Nobel Peace Prize winner way back in 2006, I believe, together with the current National Security Advisor, John Bolton.
Right.
Okay.
Now, I just want to know one thing when we bring our guest on. You said that he wrote and published in a day. I just want to know, how did he write a book in a day? That's what we got to find out when we come up in the next thing. I mean, he just wrote and published. If I had that ability, man, this is why this guy's amazing. He can write a book and publish it in one day. That means he must be a superstar. So we're going to bring Ken Timmerman on in just a moment. Don't go away. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
We're back from the break, and you're listening to Beyond the Matrix. Just want to remind you that we are sponsored officially by the Torah Learning Channel. TorahLearningChannel.com, the greatest place to go to find some of the best Orthodox Torah teaching in the world, 24/6. We have Ken Timmerman on the line with us right now in the studio. And he's got a real tight schedule, so we're going to get right into the questions. President Trump announced some new tough sanctions here just recently called the zero purchase of Iranian oil. What has been the reaction of the countries in EU, China, Russia, et cetera, to this idea?
First of all, I think it's important to point out that this president has a policy towards Iran. Right. The previous president had a concession policy towards Iran. This president has a policy of a tough message for the Iranian regime, a welcoming message to the Iranian people. I think when he goes to Moscow, for example, that he's going to also be telling Mr. Putin, you can be with us on the winning side on Iran, or you can be with the losers. I don't think the president has to offer anything to Putin, by the way. I think he just has to make it clear that Putin can be with the winners or he can be with the losers. Right now, he's on the losing side. Look, this zero purchase policy is going to cripple the Iranian economy.
Yes.
The Europeans don't care, per se. They don't need Iranian oil. Even the Chinese don't need Iranian oil. The United States has made clear ahead of time that there will be alternatives to the oil being taken off the market. We're not going to see oil at $140 a barrel as it was in 2014. It'll probably stay up at $75, $80, maybe even $100 a barrel shortly for a short period of time. But the Saudis will make up some of the slack. The Russians will make up some of the slack. And guess what? The United States of America is going to be picking up some of the slack. We're increasing oil production every single day through new hydraulic fracturing technologies, side drilling, and everything else. The U.S., the Permian Basin, East Texas.
We're at a peak right now.
West Texas, excuse me. They're going gangbusters.
Yes.
I mean, it's just amazing what's happening. So this is going to have a huge impact on the Iranian economy and the Iranian regime. I think it could really bring the mullahs to their knees.
Yes.
Speaking about that, Ken, there have been a wave of protests in both Tehran and many cities in the provinces over the drought, hyperinflation, and currency devaluation. Is Iran poised for an economic meltdown, possible regime change, and what should be the plausible U.S. and Israel strategies?
Well, you know, of course, that the reason it's not raining in Iran, according to the mullahs, is because of the Jews.
And the snow. And the snow. That came out yesterday.
Yeah,
they're taking
you
the
are
snow.
Aware of that.
Yes,
I hope.
Yes,
it's all because of the Jews.
We have an inside scoop with the Mossad. They just told us that.
That's it. And so now we know who Allah actually gets his orders from.
Right.
So that's also good to know. But on a more serious note, look, the regime's in big trouble. They are in big trouble. These protests have not gone away. They started it in December. They started at the very core of the regime. And Mashhad, the second, quote, holiest city in Iran, it just means that there are a lot of mullahs in Mashhad, and they have big multi-billion-dollar foundations, money that they control. They ship money around the world to support terrorist operations. That's headquartered in Mashhad. That's what's holy, by the way, to the Iranian regime. They can't seem to crack down successfully. They're killing people all the time. The regime is killing people all the time. They've jailed over 8,000 people. They're trying to crack the communications so the protesters can't coordinate amongst themselves. And yet the protests continue.
Right.
And now in the past couple of days, they've been in the big cities again, not just out in the countryside, but in the big cities. This is a huge problem for the regime, because the protests are no longer just focused on the economy. They're focused on the regime. People are saying, we don't want this regime anymore.
Ken, quick question for you. What makes this different? I think I know the answer, but what makes this different now compared to what it was during the Obama administration when they started some protests and a bunch of people were killed and finally quelled?
Well, because now you have a U.S. administration.
Thank you. Yes.
That is saying, we support the freedom of the Iranian people.
And
and
hopefully the EU and NATO as well. Now, I don't know what we'll do with Turkey.
I wouldn't hold my breath for the EU. The Europeans are disgracefully seeking to defend their commercial advantage. Their companies continue to supply critical technology, including surveillance technology, to the Iranian regime. Siemens has been notoriously bad about this, but others as well. I wouldn't hold my breath on the Europeans. But the U.S. absolutely has stated, Pompeo, our Secretary of State, has stated quite clearly that the United States would like to see the end of the mullah regime in Iran. And that's an extraordinary thing to come from the very top of the U.S. government.
Ken, what do you think the administration should do in this context with roiling unrest throughout Iran? How do we transition to regime change? You've been an expert about talking about that for a couple of decades now.
Well, funny thing you should ask me. If you go to my Twitter feed, which is at Ken Timmerman, you'll see there's a picture pinned to the top of me talking to Donald Trump in April of 2016. What you don't see in the picture is the three-page policy brief on how we transition to an anti-regime overthrow strategy in Iran that I had just handed him and he had just put in the inside pocket of his suit. So the administration has a lot of very good ideas, not just from me, but from other people, of what to do, how to do it. The things that you do openly. We need to reform our government broadcasting, Voice of America, mm-hmm. Radio Free Europe, Radio Farda, all of that stuff. And that is in train, but it has not yet kicked in. But there are things that the government can do covertly. And what they could do covertly, obviously, I have no interest in talking about.
Right.
But
right.
There are many things that they can do covertly. There are things, by the way, that some of the opposition groups that exist on the inside are doing covertly. Why is it, do you suppose, that this time around we're getting huge amounts of video footage of the protests
right.
and of the crackdowns?
Technology.
Stuff wasn't coming out before. Well, they're getting access to technology to get around the censorship and get that information to the public. The regime likes to kill in darkness. This technology is lighting up the Iranian countryside, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
Ken, the Kurds, your friends, the PDKI guys in northwestern Iraq, seem to be active these days, and they've also become public. One of their representatives was in Washington in June. What are they doing?
Well, the PDKI, or the KDPI, the Kurdish Democratic Party, is a kind of old-line, traditionalist, tribal party. They, for many, many years, kind of made their peace with the Iranian regime. They've seen the success of PAJAK, which is really the active group inside Iran, and they're trying to mimic it. Unfortunately, they don't have the skills, the military skills, or the infiltration skills, and their guys tend to get rounded up and jailed and executed. So they've lost a bunch of people over the past year. They've tried to blame PAJAK for failed operations. But what it suggests to me is that the opposition in general, as a whole, recognizes that the time has come.
Mm-hmm.
They are now, all of these groups are trying to stake out territory. They're trying to animate their followers, their supporters. And KDPI, which had been a dying party, frankly, is trying mm-hmm. to revive itself by mimicking the successful operations of a group like PAJAK,
right.
whose camps I have visited in the Kandil Mountains at 13,000 feet on the border between Iraq and Iran. They are the real deal, and I think you're going to be hearing more about them as well in the coming months.
So do these guys, just real quick follow up on that, do these guys have a pretty tight infrastructure when it comes to civil infrastructure in their towns, et cetera, in their government?
The KDPI,
right.
you mean?
Yeah.
No, the KDPI has no infrastructure inside Iran. PAJAK does.
Okay.
They have militants. They have party operatives all over the place, not just in Kurdistan and in Kermanshah, but in Tehran itself. In the 2009 uprising, there were many PAJAK members who were rounded up in Tehran, and many of them executed. So they are all over the country. It's not widely known. I know it because I have very close relationships with them.
Now, the PAJAK, just real quick, what is their political leading so the audience will know exactly who these people are?
So PAJAK is a secular, anti-Islamist, pro-Western party that would like to see a pluralist, a federal Iran where all groups, whether they're ethnic minorities or religious minorities, all groups will have their representation, but they will all be within a single Iranian nation.
Ah, brilliant.
Ken, the other minority group are these Sunni Arabs in Khuzestan, in the southwest of the country. They were the ones who were protesting against the foul water conditions there.
We're going to have to take this question after the break because we're getting ready to go to a break. So have you finished the question fully?
I have.
Okay, good. So, Ken, when we come back from the break, if you could remember that, and I know, Jerry, you have brilliant memory.
I will,
you'll be able to zero in.
Reiterate.
Just a reminder that Torah Learning Channel is their sponsor, is the official sponsor for Beyond the Matrix, and we want to encourage you to take advantage. Go to TorahLearningChannel.com. You'll be able to also view it on Roku, Amazon Fire, YouTube app, etc. 24 hours a day, you can learn with the best English Torah teachers in the world, so don't miss the opportunity to experience some of the greatest teaching in the world. TorahLearningChannel.com. We will be right back after these messages.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country. From Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Jerry and I really want to thank you, the listener, for making Beyond the Matrix the amazing show it is. We get a tremendous hundreds of downloads on each one of our podcasts each week, and it really makes it more exciting for us to do this when we know that we have very grateful listeners. We'd like to hear from you sometime. Send me an email, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com. Jerry, would you like to pick up with where you left off before the break?
Yes, Ken, in southwestern Iran, there's another ethnic minority who, frankly, had been behind the protests about the fouled water management system in a place called Khuzestan. What else have they done to assist in possible regime change there?
Well, here's the little known fact. Iran is not Persian.
That's correct.
People forget this. Iran is at most 50% Persian, maybe 49%, maybe 51%, but all the rest are minority groups, ethnic minorities who have been repressed by this Shiite Tehran-dominated regime.
Very good.
So you have the Khuzestan Arabs there in the south. You go north and you get the tribal groups, the Lurs, the Bakhtiaris. You go north of that, you get the Kurds. North of that, you're in Azeri territory with along the border with Azerbaijan. You go over to the other side and you've got Baluchis and more Azeris and Turkomens, and they all hate the regime. This is one of the great weaknesses of the regime. And what's tremendously interesting is that all of those ethnic minority groups are on the borders of Iran. So if a certain large country ever wanted to have access to supporters inside Iran or to help groups inside Iran,
right,
there are lots of land borders.
Absolutely.
Manned by very unhappy people, or at least populated with very unhappy people, where that large country would be able to pick up support, I believe.
One of the things that you know about that is not terribly well known about is what Israel does in terms of direct communications with population in Iran. And that goes back pretty far, doesn't it, Ken?
Well, it does. And today, I think Israel has been using its resources on intelligence operations. We saw that with the Atomic Archive, brilliantly done. Apparently, not a single Israeli asset was lost, had been discovered by the Iranian regime. But Israel has limited resources. And, Israeli leaders tell me that frequently when it comes to Iran. You know, we can't really help the pro-democracy movement per se. We can give them some guidance if they want it, but we don't have huge pots of money, for example, to distribute.
So therefore, it's left to a large unidentified country to perhaps pursue those activities.
Well, look, the Iranians don't need money, frankly. They don't need weapons. They need political and diplomatic support. They need communication support, secure communications, things like that. But this is a big country, and it's a relatively, you know, even though it's poorer than it was at the time of the Shah, it's still a relatively rich country. They have assets. They have resources. They need the political and diplomatic backing.
And that includes their diaspora in the West?
And that includes the diaspora in the West that has been split. Many of them have made their peace with the regime. It's unfortunate, but they have for primarily economic reasons. But others have not. And many of those people are extremely wealthy.
Okay.
So, Jerry, should we get on to talking about this book? I've been wanting to talk about it.
Okay.
You have another question?
Ken, this new book that you have has an interesting character, a relative of the late Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist Party figure who appears to be a double agent recruited by the CIA. Is there any factual basis for that? And what examples can you cite of how former Ba'athist military became the core of the ISIS security system that launched its rise in both Syria and Iraq?
Well, there you go. That's how ISIS begins. And that's the title of the book. That's why it's the title of the book. ISIS is, in fact, the combination or the union of the former Ba'athist intelligence networks and the jihadi networks inside Iraq. You see how they operate in my book. This is actually one of the first novels of the Iraq War. There haven't been an awful lot that have come out yet. And my main character is an Assyrian Christian interpreter. To anybody who has served in Iraq, he will be a very familiar character. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Americans who've served in Iraq, we're dealing with people like this, right, all the time. They call them TERPs, interpreters. And so they'll recognize my guy. His name is Johannes, but he uses the American nickname Johnny.
Right?
He's called Johnny. And so you have a very recognizable character in the at the center of this book. He tells the story of the persecution of his family. He's on operations with a U.S. Spec Ops team, you know, taking down a jihadi group. They discover this strange text. The Americans think it must be written in code, but in fact, it's written in Aramaic, which Johnny, of course, can read.
Yes, of course.
And so this is part of the plot line of the book. It's a fun book, and there's lots of twists and turns of the plot. But I did want to keep it, while it is a fiction, I did want to keep it close enough to reality that people who have been to Iraq or served in Iraq would immediately recognize it. Anybody who's been to northern Iraq will immediately understand, will immediately recognize my descriptions of the road between Erbil and Mosul,
right,
and the dangers that lurk in the desert there. They'll know that immediately. It'll immediately hit home to them. I also had a couple weapons techs who helped me on my selection of weaponry in the book. And you'll see there are a lot of Glock 19s, but there's also a Barrett Light 50 that comes in from time to time and does its thing. And at the end, of course, there's a fuel air explosive, which is a rather unusual weapon. But I happen to know something about that from personal experience as well, having been held in Beirut in 1982 in a building that was the first time since Vietnam it was blown up with a fuel air explosive by the Israeli Air Force 2 hours after I was released from the building. So a little personal experience thrown into that as well.
Wow. Was there any CIA treatment of these Ba'athists who were forming the core of what became ISIS, or?
Well, let me just say this, an attentive eye might recognize some of the characters in my book. You know, they would certainly recognize a certain U.S. ambassador who makes an appearance. They might recognize a southern governor who makes an appearance in the book. They might recognize some former CIA officers or former U.S. military officers who make appearances in the book. But that, of course, would merely be an extraordinary coincidence, Jerry.
Okay, Rod?
So at the start of the Second Gulf War in 2003, we're going to go way back. There was approximately 1.4 million Iraqi Christians, or Chaldean Assyrian Christians, in northern Iraq and on the plains of biblical Nineveh. What is their long troubled heritage and conflicts that are that we can see with Saddam Hussein and the regime, with his regime, and with the Kurds and Iran controlling Iraqi Shia population? What is the current status now with many of these people?
Well, the tragedy is of that 1.5 million population before the 2003 liberation of Iraq, it's now about 280,000-300,000 at most.
Mm.
There has been a religious side of Iraqi Christians. And that's why I wrote ISIS Begins. I wanted Americans, especially Christian Americans, but not only Christian Americans, I wanted Americans to recognize what's going on, to recognize that Christians are being persecuted in Iraq under our very eyes.
Right.
And as we ourselves were militarily occupying the country, Christians were being murdered for their faith, and we did nothing about
right.
it. And the reason, again, I chose this Iraqi Christian interpreter as my central character, and he gets chased by the jihadis. I wanted you to be able to feel and smell and taste
That's
what it's
good.
Like to be a Christian in those circumstances. When you look around you in a crowd and you understand that half the people who are there, if not more, all want to kill you.
Now, let me ask you, how many of these do you think that depleted during the time were people who just became refugees and went to another country somewhere? Were there that many?
No, most of them were driven out because of this conscious, ruthless effort at religicide to right. eradicate the Iraqi Christian population. Some became refugees because they had gone into the Kurdish areas, and while the Kurds welcomed them, the Kurds also have this kind of imperial relationship towards the Assyrian Christians, where they deny their identity. Mm-hmm. They want them to become Christian Kurds. Well, they're not Christian Kurds.
Right.
They are Assyrians, and
right.
that is a separate ethnic identity.
Right.
Or they are Chaldean Syriacs. It's a separate ethnic identity, and the Kurds have had a real hard time recognizing it. So some people have been driven out for those reasons as well.
Okay.
They see no possibility of developing their homeland.
Well, when we get back, Jerry, you have a question that you want to ask, but one of the things that I find very intriguing is that during that time in 2003 to 6 or 7 or 8, we saw this huge concerted effort for Assyrian Christian groups in the West trying to provide aid. Some of these people were literally being starved in their villages, in their area where they lived. And we're just basically just being starved to death. It reminded me of the stuff we used to hear about in history in Russia that was going on with Jews. It was a very dark time. When we come back, we're going to be picking up the questions here. Jerry has a question for Ken. We're talking to Ken Timmerman here on Israel News Talk Radio, Beyond the Matrix. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Thank you for tuning in. We are in our third segment, I think, right now. This is the third segment. This is the final segment.
Yeah, no, we have to ask three questions and get out of
and
here.
And get out of here, because we know Ken cannot shut up talking. He's just going to talk. So why don't you go ahead and ask the questions, dear?
No, this is... All right,
these are good. These that. Are good. Okay. Go for it.
All right. Ready?
Ready.
Ken, we have a mutual friend, Joseph Kassab, who's been involved as an advocate for refugee resettlement for these very same Assyrian, Chaldean Christians who are still threatened as we speak. What is it this government hasn't done, and what is it this government could do to essentially save this ancient remnant from being further persecuted?
Well, there's two things. First of all, and I was involved in this effort at the end of the Bush 43 administration, we can bring people into this country. The Christian interpreters who have helped us, the people who worked at our embassy and our consulate up in the north, and who have been targeted by the jihadis, we promised them we would help get them out, and we didn't do it. When I came back from one of these mission trips in 08, Ellen Sauerbrey, who I happen to know from Maryland politics, she was the senior person at the State Department, the political appointee in charge of this. And she had no awareness whatsoever. She had never been briefed on it by her underlings, who were all the, you know, deep state people who hated Iraqi Christians and wanted to bring Muslims into this country instead. And by the way, that's what was happening through the UN refugee organizations and the rest. If you were, and I tell this story in ISIS Begins, there's a scene that's like this, and that is ripped out of my own reporting. I can tell you that when Christians go in to the UNHCR in Amman, Jordan, or other place, and they they're identified, they see their name. Oh, your name is Youssef. Oh, is it Youssef Ibrahimi, or is it So they immediately understand if they're Christian or not, and their file goes in the circular file right away, and they're basically told, come back in a year, we'll see what happens. And there's no attempt to resettle them.
Is there any logic behind that? I mean, really?
Yes. It's called jihadism. It's called Muslims who want to see the religious side of Christians in the Middle East, and that is right into the UNHCR apparatus as well, where you have these women, these veiled women, who are the intake officers, and as soon as they see a Christian coming, they basically refuse to accept their request. Wow. Now, there is a second thing today. I made a recent trip. I was there last summer again in the Nineveh Plain, northern Iraq, and just before finishing up ISIS Begins. So there's a lot of kind of fresh material here. There are groups who would like to resettle now that the Nineveh Plain has been liberated from ISIS. It is completely destroyed. Unbelievable, completely destroyed. The churches have been torn down, violated, the crosses torn down, and they would like to get people to invest in the Nineveh Plain so they can at least anchor a remnant of the community on their historic land, which, by the way, goes back to the time of St. Thomas in the first century. The Assyrian Christians were proselytized by St. Thomas. They still speak Aramaic, the language of Jesus. This is something we don't realize here in the United States. Hmm. By the way, let me just say one more thing about ISIS Begins. I also had the preeminent Assyrian Aramaic linguist assist me in those sections of the book where there are Aramaic phrases. So all of that is absolutely authentic. It has been kind of vetted and corrected and made sure that it was authentic.
So you didn't use Google Translate?
I did not use Google Translate. I first of all, remembered many of the phrases, and then I had them vetted by the Nina Lasub, who is the preeminent linguist of modern Aramaic, actually wrote the dictionary of modern Aramaic.
Ken, in ISIS Begins, one of the plot lines, which is fascinating, is a contest between jihadis versus the Vatican. These threats are arrayed against the guardians of a sacred book in the mountain monastery of Mar Hamasid on the Nineveh Plains in the town of Al-Gash. What is the significance between your fiction and a fateful meeting of an Asturian monk, Bahira, and a young Muhammad?
Well, you know, there's a long-standing Middle Eastern tradition, and it's not just a Christian tradition, that parts of the Quran were dictated to Muhammad, not by the angel Gabriel, but by a monk named Bahira, a Christian monk named Bahira. And there is even a hadith. A hadith is a saying of Muhammad, right? By the most authentic of the hadith gatherers, Salih Bukhara, that recounts the story of this monk, this Orthodox monk, who is said to be the origin, the one who actually dictated parts of the Quran. In my story, in ISIS Begin, I kind of go back to this historical document where you have the diary of these monks as they are teaching Muhammad, and they progressively become aghast. And they say, oh my gosh, what have we done? What is this monster we have begotten? You know, we were trying to spread the gospel through this guy, and in fact, he's just a sex fiend and a maniac and a murderer. And you know, you see this progressively happening in portions of the secret book of this sect. So that's one of the kind of subplots of my book, ISIS Begins. I wanted to make it fun for people to read, give you a little intrigue about the origins of Islam as well, which has authentic historical background to it. It's not purely fiction.
Wow. So what are you going to do next after ISIS Begins? You got to do another version of this?
Well, I have been prompted. I've actually finished a memoir that should be out some point next year. All fun and games, stories of my time on the road with the Lost Boys of Beirut to, you know, Baghdad. I don't want to say Baghdad Bob because I never met Baghdad Bob, but I knew, you know, I knew the emirs and the generals and the heads of the nuclear weapons programs and the rest. And there's lots of fun stories to tell.
Well, I'm surprised you haven't written that already, but that's going to be a great follow up. Is there? How can people get the book? Is it already ready to be purchased?
Yeah, ISIS Begins was released this past week. You can get it through my website, kentimmerman.com. That's probably the easiest thing to do. There's a direct link. You can see the cover picture. By the way, it's a real picture taken in the Nineveh plane of a militiaman up on the roof with a full moon behind it. It's a pretty dramatic picture, beautiful picture. And just click on the cover, ISIS Begins. It'll take you to Amazon. And you can read by looking inside the book. You can read the first chapter to see if you kind of like the way it's going. But the first chapter is a lot of fun. It's the takedown of the jihadi network with Johnny the Terp.
And, brilliant.
And this real scumbag of a terrorist there who then, in later on in the book, goes and tracks him and stalks him and murders his brother and kidnaps his sister, all kinds of
bad things. I personally can't wait to get the book. Let me ask you this. What would you like, we only have a couple of minutes now, what would you like the reader to take away from sort of for real life purposes? What would you like the reader to come away with after reading the book?
Well, I want readers to understand what it's like to be a persecuted Christian. I want readers to understand that persecution is real. It is not something made up. It's not an invention of Islamophobes, and that the jihadi groups truly go after Christians because of their faith. This is something that's hard for Americans to understand. We live in a tolerant society, even though these days it's becoming less and less tolerant. But it's hard for Americans to understand that. That's the takeaway.
Well, Jews understand this because of their history of persecution over the millennia. And it's very interesting to both Rod and me that a very considerable portion of the Torah and the Talmud is written in, guess what?
Nineveh.
Aramaic.
Aramaic, yeah. But we also have a Nineveh story, too.
Yes, the Nineveh stories. Yes, exactly.
That's correct.
They're Nineveh stories.
Right.
I have been in Nahum's tomb. The Nineveh plain in Al-Qush, which still exists, by the way. At least, I should say, I was there before ISIS came in. I don't know if it's still there now.
God only knows if it's there now, right?
Yep.
Well, the idea here with the book is brilliant. I cannot wait to get my hands on it. And look, I really want to encourage people, go to Ken Timmerman. It's TimmerMan.com. Ken Timmerman, TimmerMan.com, and you can order the book. We really encourage you to do it. Ken, it's really been a great privilege and honor to have you on board. Is there any last things? We've just got about 1 minute. Any last thing that you'd like to say before we go?
Well, thanks for having me on. And I had a lot of fun doing this book. It's more fun in a way doing fiction than it is doing my books of journalistic investigative journalism, where you've got to just stick to the facts. But of course, there was a lot of historical research that I did doing this book, and it allowed me to kind of take all of my reporter's notebooks of Amman, of northern Iraq, and the rest of it, and kind of use all of the back stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So you really feel it. You really get a sense of ground truth in this book. That's what I was trying to convey.
Well, I can't wait to get it in the hands of a couple of people I know that are still operating in those environments to get them to read the book. I think it'd be a lot of fun for them. And now you were talking about journalists and the whole idea of sticking to the facts, but I think that a lot of journalists today are novelists, not journalists.
Well, you are right about that. Sometimes I don't like to say that I started out as a novelist before I went to write journalism,
yeah,
but
exactly.
I did.
Well, again, okay. You have
it. My journalism separate from my fiction.
No, absolutely. That's what you call integrity in the newsroom. Well, look, we really appreciate it. Thank you, listener, for coming in and listening to Beyond the Matrix. You've been listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Jerry, you're a fantastic man. Thank you for sticking by my side. And Ken, we hope to have you back here in a few weeks here on Beyond the Matrix. And for now, we say shalom.
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 If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.